Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we'll talk with Andrea Van Voigt, Brian Kingston, and Flavio Volpi about North America's most traded manufactured commodity, cars, trucks, and the parts that go into them. Andrea Van Voigt is Global Director at Harper & Associates, having previously served in executive positions at Canadian Tire and the Business Council of Canada, and as Foreign and Trade Policy Advisor to then Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and as earlier as Chief of Staff to the Minister of International Trade. Brian Kingston is President of the Canadian Vehicle Manufacturers Association, having previously served as an executive at the Business Council of Canada, as well as in various federal government departments and agencies. Flavio Volpi is president of the Automotive Parts Manufacturers Association and previously managing director, Canada, of Wärtsilä AG, the EU's largest privately held solar photovoltaic energy developer. He also served as chief of staff to the Ontario Minister of Economic Development and Trade. Andrea, Brian, and Flavio, welcome to the Global Exchange.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
For listeners, Canada has been building vehicles for over a century. With a $19 billion contribution to our GDP, it is one of Canada's largest manufacturing sectors. The industry directly employs more than 125,000 people, with an additional 400,000 people in aftermarket services and dealership networks. The industry is centered in the heart of North America's largest vehicle-producing region, the Great Lakes Automotive Manufacturing Cluster. Canada is the world's 12th largest producer of light vehicles. Five global manufacturers, FCA, Ford, GM, Honda, and Toyota, assemble around 2 million vehicles at their Canadian plants each year. Their plants are supplied by an ecosystem of nearly 700 parts suppliers, including homegrown Tier 1 companies like Magna, Linamar, and Martin Ray. Canada is home to one of only five machine, tool, and mold-making clusters in the world. With its investments in emerging technologies, the industry is attracting major investments in autonomous and connected vehicle research from global manufacturers such as GM and Ford, and tech giants like Uber, Google, and NVIDIA. Have I got that right, Brian? NVIDIA?
That's right.
Good. So let's begin. My first question to you, Andrea, what does the Biden administration mean for Canada-US trade? I note that USTR nominee Katherine Tai was deeply involved in the endgame of our recent NAFTA-CUSMA USMCA negotiations.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Colin, and it's great to be with Flavio and Brian, and thanks for an interesting question. The Biden administration, I think, represents a bit of a return to normalcy for Canada-US relations. It's been a really bumpy 4 years. We've been able to, much to Brian and Flavio's hard work, been able to successfully conclude a USMCA, a new NAFTA that solidifies the auto sector in Canada and modernizes a really out-of-date agreement. And I believe that the Biden administration will continue to carry forward USMCA in a productive, constructive way without any of the potential partisan hangups that you might have seen after a change in government. And for the first time in our trading relationship since NAFTA, you don't have one party or another talking about how they need to renegotiate the trade deal that exists between Canada and the US and Canada, the US and Mexico. I think one of the biggest indicators that we're going to see continued success in the trading relationship and in the implementation of USMCA is, as you mentioned, the nominee for USTR is Katherine Tai, a remarkably impressive woman. Her undergraduate degree is from Yale. Her law degree is from Harvard. She's done graduate work as well at other prestigious institutions. She spent 7 years doing trade enforcement against China when she was at USTR. Until very recently was the top Democrat representative on the Ways and Means committee as trade counsel, and was, as you said, intimately involved in the closing negotiation, well, throughout the negotiations on USMCA, but particularly in the closing or the end times of the negotiations, although the end times were successful in this instance. But, you know, I think in particular, given labor was such a key element of those talks, I think what you'll see is both continued implementation, but also a real eye to enforcement, because she personally was intimately involved, but they also have strong interest in this with respect to Congress. I think what I would conclude with saying is that, you know, despite the fact that I think it'll be returned to normalcy and we're going to see strong implementation of USMCA, you know, that doesn't mean that it's going to be roses and sunshine and rainbows and unicorns. I think we'll still see the things that have been age-old issues between our countries. You know, softwood lumber, I think, will be an issue for forever. You know, there's a dairy conversation that's going to happen under USMCA. We're going to have some conversations about Buy America, and hopefully we'll see some progress on that. But that should not suggest to anybody that the trade relationship isn't going to be positive or constructive. It's just what happens when countries, two countries in particular, trade as much and are as integrated as we are, that we're always going to have some bumps in the road.
Thanks, Andrea. Brian, we've now got the new agreement. We call it CUSMA Canada or USMCA, TEDMAC, whatever we're going to use. Did the NAFTA renegotiation effectively move aside that boogeyman that was NAFTA, that was particularly of concern to protectionist elements in the Democratic Party, but more generally, certainly Mr. Trump campaigned against and said he would renegotiate NAFTA. NAFTA became kind of a dirty word. Now it's no longer NAFTA. Have we managed to exercise that? But at the same time, as Andrea just alluded to, part of Mr. Biden's platform and Made in America includes Buy American provisions.
Yeah, I think, you know, on the one hand, yes, by addressing the longstanding concerns that we saw coming out of the U.S. With NAFTA, it does give us some breathing room, if you will. You know, it's hard to imagine in the next couple of years calls out of the U.S. for, you know, tearing up the USMCA or yet another renegotiation. We've gone through the very painful process of getting this agreement. And so that gives some certainty for the coming years with that agreement in place. That said, it does not mean that, you know, and to Andrew's point, that suddenly everything's going to be fine. It'll be much more positive with respect to, you know, things like Section 232 and the tariffs we saw in steel and aluminum, some of the more protectionist and challenging issues that were brought up by the Trump administration. We won't have to deal with that necessarily, but we're still going to have protectionist sentiment and policies coming out of the U.S., which Canada always has to be on guard for and work with the administration to address. And, you know, the best example of that, having gone through the Biden platform in detail, there's a lot in there around kind of a supercharged Buy America to make sure that, you know, for example, a few things that are highlighted, you know, tightening domestic content rules for government procurement, cracking down on Buy America waivers, which provide the ability to go outside of the Buy America provision. So we're going to have to watch that closely. In the past, Canada, thanks to, you know, an absolutely fantastic team in Washington, has been able to focus the U.S. on a North American approach, given that we are such an integrated market. But it's always a risk and something that we have to watch. And, you know, just one example directly related to vehicles, we see in the Biden platform support for what's called the Clean Cars for America proposal, which is an attempt to basically get more Americans to adopt zero emission or electric vehicles. And the intention of that is to actually give consumers a cash voucher to trade in their vehicle, their gas-powered vehicle, but it will only apply if you purchase a U.S.-assembled plug-in electric vehicle, hydrogen fuel cell car. So it's policies like that, which we have to be really careful about, because we don't build vehicles in Canada for the Canadian market. We build vehicles for a North American market and in some instances for global markets. So it's really important that we always remind the Americans that we build things together. And that's not going to change under a Biden administration.
Okay, that's a good segue. And I'm going to put this question to you, Flavio, about the implementation of the new agreement. As Brian says, we've maintained the principle going back to the Auto Pact that it is certainly Canada-US and now North American platform, and if it meets the regulatory rules, then it conforms. But what Brian's suggesting is that under Mr. Biden, there may be some question about that. What are you hearing from your counterparts? And do you think it's reasonable for us to expect to be able to sort of include Canada at least and as much of Mexico as possible, given the concerns about labor, under our newly agreed Canada-US-Mexico agreement, United States-Mexico-Canada agreement? Because we spent an awful lot of time in that agreement. I know months just working around rules of origin and autos.
Good question. As your listeners might know, I attended participated in every negotiating round through 2017 through 2019, and even the non-round rounds, dealing with all three different countries' negotiating teams, and I give that context for a reason. The negotiating teams are professional trade officials who, for the most part, in all three countries, see the threats and opportunities in a continental agreement the same way. The external threat for our industry is the strength and the quality and the state-owned orientation of Chinese competition. For us, USMCA implementation was always going to be aggressive. The Trump administration had suggested that we're going to do it in 3 years on regional value content levels, going up from 62.5% in vehicles up to 75%. It's very aggressive. The rules themselves, the new rules that say, by the way, there's core parts categories. Within those core parts categories, if you're sourcing metals, steel or aluminum, 70% of those have to come from North American sources. Those rules came into play immediately. For the most part, in spite of the fact that the USMCA, CUSMA, came into effect in the middle of a pandemic, and there are restrictions and constraints there, and that uniform regulations didn't actually get given to any of us until essentially the date was launched. The industry is going to make its timeframes and its markers because of another instrument in this agreement, which is the alternative staging plans.
The alternative staging
plans.
Yeah.
Every vehicle maker was given the option to request from all three different countries separately a five-year extension to the roll-up of local content and the new rules. What they had to do was lay bare their plans for the next 5 years and their supply chain dynamics and ask for an extension. Those have not yet been adjudicated. And so every single automaker who knows they've got to do this within the next 3 years also knows that a new administration is going to weigh in on the reasonability of doing that over the next 3 years. And we think the orientation of the American government will be, for instance, FCA's Ram line launched a new truck in 2019. We think that probably has a seven-year life. The cost to FCA and then the cost to jobs for their Dodge division the impact on their profit lines probably means that the U.S. government is USTR will grant them that extension. We know the Canadians and the Mexicans are looking at the Americans for guidance there. We're certainly not going to do anything in this country or in that or in Mexico to harm Canadian and Mexican interests versus the American ones. And so I think what we're going to see on this implementation is a lot of decisions on alternative staging plans. We're going to see the new dynamic take longer than 3 years, maybe up to 8 years in total, but it's a reasonable one that will benefit all three countries. And like Andrea said, whether you agree with the Biden administration's politics or not is less relevant. It will be less relevant over the next 4 years because you'll be able to predict professionally where they'll be on any given issue, which is a new element, considering the nonsense that we've dealt with in the outgoing administration.
Flavio, as a follow-up, the adjudication panels you talked about, are those trilateral, or are those American Who names the players on them, or is it sort of appointed by government? How does that work?
It is the designated trade authority in each country, USTR, Global Affairs Canada, and the department in Mexico. Each of the three countries has an independent ability to either grant that extension or not. But the coordination, beyond the politics and the headlines and the tweets of the last 3 years, the coordination between those three organizations has been extraordinary. For example, Canada had to pen on the uniform regulations that of course, have to be observed in all three countries. Canada had to pen, USTR and Mexico then worked on Canada's first draft. It's that type of cooperation that we see. So there may be an instance where the Americans or the Mexicans may want to grant an extension on a line on a program that Canada may or may not want to. But given the interconnected nature of supply chains throughout all three countries, I don't predict that happening ever. If it does, it is, even though formally there isn't a panel, a trilateral panel there, all of them understand that if Canada had an advantage, for example, to gain from an automaker perspective and decided to extend an alternative staging plan that the U.S. did not want to, the argument for the U.S. to go along with it is very simple. 60% of those the parts in Canadian manufacturing vehicle manufacturing lines come from the U.S. So whether we're aligned at the OEM level on a specific file or not, we're always aligned on the parts and raw material side, and we usually find a way to accommodate each other.
So what you're saying is that we really still are a very much an integrated North American industry, and that's how we should look at this.
We're now formally more integrated than we were before the signing of the USMCA.
Andrea, the treaty contains a sunset clause, which got a lot of concern and attention from the media when the agreement was announced. My view, sort of sense, is that there's usually that provision of 6 months, country going to give notice, pull it anyways. How concerned should we be by that sunset clause?
Look, I it's a bit hard to say because, you know, I think the last 4 years, if we've learned anything, it should be don't look into a crystal ball and think you can predict the future. However, I think that a sunset clause was going to be essential to getting congressional approval for the deal. And I think that in a constructive, nonpartisan environment, a sunset clause isn't in theory, the notion of a review clause isn't a bad idea. The idea that we gather together, we review things that didn't work as well as we thought when we originally negotiated the agreement. You know, if there have been advancements in technology or border procedures or technology with respect to managing the border, we're able to reflect those in an updated agreement. And perhaps you could revisit some issues that didn't get dealt with, you know, namely labor being a big one. And when I say labor, I'm more mean the really immigration and the movement of skilled workers. But in a partisan environment, it's where you get a little bit more anxious that games, and I'll refer to them as games, will be played around getting reauthorization. But, you know, in all honesty, I don't think anyone has a big appetite for going through what we've been through for the last 4 years and through the negotiations. And I think that the fact that it received bipartisan support and such strong bipartisan support and support in all three countries, I think means that the danger is a lot lower.
And certainly there's a lot of, this agreement seems to have lots of continuing committees looking at things like competitiveness and keeping the agreement evergreen, which to your point about a trade agreements needing to be re-examined and refreshed, certainly that should feed into that and probably do a better job than I think we did in the NAFTA, where a lot of those committees we set up became sort of redundant after a year or so.
Yeah. Is that fair? Yeah, that's actually a really good point, Colin. I think, you know, those committees are going to require a little bit of senior level attention. And I'm not referring to the committees that Flavio and Brian care very, very much about, because I think that those will be robust. But the committee's work, the work being robust, the committees having strong appointees that are committed to their agenda, which should be a collective agenda, should help to head off any big issues that could come up through a sunset review. But you know, we've seen some evidence in the past that committees can fall by the wayside and not be as productive or constructive. But hopefully, we won't see that happen in this instance. And I don't think we will.
No, and I think, as you said, and Brian, I'll turn to you now. It strikes me, and you would agree, I think, Flavio, that certainly the committees you're involved in are going to remain active simply because it's such an important industry.
Brian. Yes, well, and if I could just add to that, too, on the sunset clause, one of the features of it is that after 6 years after signature, that's when the first joint review takes place. And if the parties don't agree to extend the agreement for another 16 years, then you have to have a joint review every year for 10 years. And while that sounds, you know, potentially ominous, on the flip side, having a joint mandated joint review like that of an agreement does effectively make it a living agreement, because it will create and force a venue for issues that have come up to be addressed. So, you know, if there are some other things like the, you know, the competitiveness chapter or, you know, the regulatory reform chapter that aren't making progress, there is potential that through this joint review mechanism, it will force progress on elements of the agreement that need to be improved. Now, I mean, that's the positive spin on this. The negative spin is that it could be, you know, a joint review on an annual basis becomes a way for every complaint about North American trade to be flagged, creates a lot of work and a lot of problems for the agreement. So it could go both ways, but I do think that, you know, one of the big issues with NAFTA was the fact that it didn't get updated, and a lot of those committees went dark. And I hope that with this new agreement, we won't face that challenge.
Brian, you spoke about the border, and actually this one I want Flavio to come in on as well. The border remains closed, but I have the impression, but I would like you to verify, that the supply chains on which your industry depends seem to be working. Brian and then Flavio, is that correct?
Yeah, there's good news and bad news here. I mean, on the one hand, things have been working well. And, you know, my immediate concern when we did see the border closure was, of course, that you would see an impact on the movement of goods. And, you know, given the huge volume of vehicle trade that moves across the Canada-US border every day, any sort of delay can be disastrous for the industry. But largely, and you know, credit to all the officials working at the border and the truckers that keep product moving, the supply chains have generally held up. There were, of course, delays due to, you know, COVID outbreaks in the early stages when facilities actually shut down, not just in North America, but in other parts of the world. But mostly, goods trade continues to move effectively across the border. Where we've seen challenges more recently has been on the movement of people and expertise. And, you know, for vehicle assemblers, you know, there is a huge amount of expertise that comes across the border on a pretty regular basis. And this can be to do everything from inspecting machinery on the line, installing or maintaining new equipment, or even in the R&D space, where there's a lot of auto R&D now being done in Ontario and in Canada, you'll see experts coming from the U.S. To Canada to do some of that work. The challenge we're finding now is because of the restrictions and some of the inconsistencies with respect to interpreting those rules around moving across the border, that it's causing problems for manufacturers. So that's an area that we need to resolve quickly because it's starting to have an economic impact. And particularly with the new investments, we've got nearly $5 billion in new investment by Ford, FCA, and General Motors announced recently into Canada. Those investments, as they start to proceed, we're going to need people and expertise from the U.S. to make that happen. So the movement of people is an issue. Hopefully, as we get the vaccine rolled out and COVID starts to become less of a threat, that will be resolved. But it is a problem right now.
Brian, is that a problem from Americans coming into Canada or Canadians going to the United States, or pretty much the same on both sides? And is it specific to particular ports of entry and sometimes individuals. I know we've had this challenge in the past, and there were often various, you could almost slot it into what were the challenges. Sometimes you got somebody who was difficult to border. Sometimes it was simply at a border station, they were interpreting the rules differently than others were. And so we had to weigh in. Is it, what is the problem?
The problem is largely Americans coming into Canada, although there have been instances going the other way. And it really relates to just interpretations of the orders in council that have been issued that dictate who can come into the country. So, you know, all of the auto manufacturers have put in place very strict health and safety rules to make sure that it's only essential workers that are making those movements across the border. But we still find that, you know, day in and day out, there are issues dealing with direct border agents who are making decisions whether or not someone's travel is legitimate, essential or not. And so it continues to be a big challenge. And I know that Flavio and his industry has faced the same. It's not just something that's affecting the auto industry. This is, you know, manufacturing writ large.
So Flavio, you know, you've, as you pointed out, were deeply involved in negotiations. You know who the players are. Are you finding them receptive to the challenges that you're facing just in getting the people back and forth across the border?
The answer to receptive is yes. Whether they are react to those inputs right now is a difficult question to answer. Over the last 10 months or so, we've seen the restrictions on both sides of the border, similar restrictions on every border, commercial border around the world. I think we saw a lot more seamless transportation, cross-border and mobility for labor when we haven't been at peaks, you know, the first and second peak. And now that we're in peak, we're seeing a lot of the people that have been able to go back and forth, specialists, executives responsible for launches, get stopped at a thicker border. On both sides, but we've expressed directly to the authorities in Canada what we thought that meant for impact on Canadian trade. I want to make the distinction between goods and people. Goods have had unfettered access throughout the process. I think governments on both sides of the border have been very good on that piece. On personnel, what it does is, you know, we're an industry that has embraced a lean, efficient production as a matter of course for competition against major global players for the last 20 years, but especially in the last 5 years or so. And what happens is where you can share a resource within a jurisdiction, you know, within North America, specialist teams, you do that. And so you may have operations in Canada, US, and Mexico, but you have a team, an engineering team for launches and for fixes based in Indiana or Ontario, and that service Saltillo. And it's those teams that have been held up. Program launches, for your listeners, what that means is if one of Brian's members decides that they're launching a new truck line next month, that trickles down to the 300 suppliers that they have on launching a new line to coincide with that the just-in-time delivery of that new product. And so getting to a launch, senior executives at a launch and making sure that it goes on those days are very critical. It's been really tough last few months. In Canada, that usually is usually a discussion with immigration, citizenship and immigration. More and more, this is about public safety and the delegated authority to specific Canadian border service agents. What we found is getting into the U.S. has been relatively easier than getting back into Canada. You know, I think everybody can make whatever inference they want from that. On the Canadian side, Nexus travelers are having an easier time of it than those in regular lines. And, you know, we're seeing things like the border's a little thicker sometimes in Windsor and sometimes in Sarnia, and it moves around. The lack of forecastability, and certainly, you know, I represent 300 companies. Some of the bigger ones, C-suite executives, have been pushed into quarantine, you know, on a similar trip through the same port, you know, from 1 week to another, or if they were American-based, you know, rejected at the border. There's no remedy here. I think we all need the vaccine rollout to help this out. I don't think it affects long-term trade relationships, and certainly not a fault of the government agencies here. We're in an unprecedented space, and as long as the goods keep flowing, these will be issues that I think that we can discuss and try to find a solution to. If this were to bleed into goods, then we'd have a problem. And I don't see that happening for either side of the border.
Flavio, you raised the whole question of border, and turn to you, Andrea, because I consider you one of the authorities who have worked hard on beyond the border and regulatory cooperation, particularly in your time in government. As the border reopens, and Flavio points out, certainly the health screen, I think, is now going to be imposed along with the security screen we've seen since 9/11 and the trade and customs screen that's always been at a border. Should we not be taking this as an opportunity to kind of reimagine how the border works? And I know this is an area that you have a real interest in. Give us an example of the kind of initiatives you think that might have some life that we should be looking at as the border reopens.
Thanks. So just to follow on what Brian and Flavio have said, I think there's immense credit to be given to the federal government and the provincial governments and Flavio and Brian and their members for being able to ensure the efficient movement of goods during the pandemic. Like it is remarkable that the governments were all able to cooperate with the private sector and as best as they could to make sure that there wasn't a slowdown, because that could have had disastrous effects on a whole number of fronts. And it's also an example, and you know, look, I will not compliment the US administration, but at levels beneath the president, it is also a tribute to the fact that the two countries, regardless of bad politics, are working together to ensure that the movement of goods at least is working. What I worry about it going forward, and Colin, you and I have talked about this before, what I worry about going forward is the impact of the pandemic on the border in a few different ways. The long-lasting effects of the pandemic, I think, one of them will be this notion of the safe movement of people. And, you know, this thing that people have been talking about, whether or not you need a vaccine passport, whether Nexus holders need to have, you know, their vaccine status added to their card and their profile when they cross the border. What worries me is that, at least from a public perspective, and from what I've been able to find out from a government perspective, there's a lack of coordination or standardization on, you know, what documentation can be provided by the governments that will be standardized really around the world so that people can travel fairly freely. And though we've learned that, you know, things like Zoom and other online platforms have facilitated business, there is some business and some work that cannot be done virtually. And, you know, Flavio gave good examples of it, but we have had clients who have teams that service machinery and equipment in the United States from Canada that have not been allowed to enter the United States by land. And as a result, our clients are in the difficult position of having to make a decision about hiring US teams in order to service machinery and equipment. And that's not a situation anybody wants to be in, where, you know, we're not able to keep Canadians employed because of a challenge with crossing the border. So, you know, I think there's an important conversation to be had there. The other one is, if you talk to CBP and CBSA, you hear a lot about modernization and pilot projects and new technology and creating the border of the future. And there are many really outstanding organizations that are working on what that looks like. The other effect, the longer lasting effect of the pandemic, is the sapping of resources, I fear, from public safety and CBSA redirected towards, you know, just making sure that the border is safe, sapping resources that would have gone to that modernization agenda. And going forward, we'll get redirected towards health, safety, and the security of the person, rather than looking at, you know, things like facial recognition and other things that means our side of the border will fall behind. I'm worried. But I also think that the same situation is going to exist on the US side. So perhaps we'll fall back together. But I do think that this area, and as I think as we would all agree, all of us on this call and hopefully your folks that are listening, we renegotiated USMCA to some extent as business, because we believe that good trade rules make us more competitive and more efficient than other parts of the world. And we are only as competitive and efficient as our borders allow us to be. And so if we thicken the border, either because, you know, we don't have good systems to allow people to move freely and fast and efficiently, or we are not able to modernize in order to make sure the goods are moving as efficiently and quickly as possible, then we will create additional costs and delays for our businesses, which will mean that we are less competitive. I do think, though, that both from a pandemic planning and go forward perspective, but also just from a future border agenda, I do think this is a great area for the two governments to work on together. You know, we have to ditch the name Beyond the Border and Regulatory Cooperation Council, because that belonged to other leaders. But I think we do need a plan for the future. And though you were asking about the border, I'll just throw in a plug for regulatory cooperation. You know, man, if there's anything that's underlined the need for a really thorough conversation about a real agenda on regulatory cooperation, you know, the regulatory approval process in Canada and the United States on things like masks and gloves and vaccines, we have to do a better job. And I think that, you know, again, call it something else, cast it in a different way, we need to have a forward-looking agenda on this.
All right. My last question, and I want each of you to speak to this one, is sometime in February, the Prime Minister is probably going to have a virtual meeting with Mr. Biden, probably not in person. The auto industry is, of course, as I said at the outset, absolutely vital in North America, but particularly to Canada and the United States, and freer trade since 1965. And a remarkably dynamic industry, as Flavio in particular will appreciate, and something that Mr. Biden has said, well, he's got, you know, future standards for carbon emissions and then electric vehicles. What advice would you want Prime Minister Trudeau to take to the table when he has that conversation with Mr. Biden around the auto industry? You've got sort of one ask, as they put it. Flavio, what would it be?
I think that if he impresses upon Mr. Biden that American interests are Canadian interests, are Mexican interests from an automotive perspective, that the three countries together actually as an industry are one, that General Motors Canada is as much a Canadian company as Magna in Michigan is an American company. And so don't make decisions that are what you think are in your national interests, because they're not. And that just like we explained to President Trump, that putting a tariff on cars made in Canada means you're going to make it more difficult for Ford and Chrysler and Dodge and General Motors to sell vehicles to Americans with 60% American parts and 50% American raw materials. It's important that on a go-forward basis, a new administration knows that that Canada's auto sector is a critical part of the American experience in this business and the American leadership in this business, and to find other places to be a nationalist on, and consider us a partner in whatever their foreign orientation vis-a-vis China, Europe, Japan, instead of doing what the outgoing administration did.
Brian, as I sort of listened to Flavio, I think, look, don't tinker. We've got this new agreement. It's working. We're working stuff out, and it is potentially a strength for North America. What would you tell the Prime Minister?
Well, first, I, of course, agree with what Flavio has laid out. I mean, that's absolutely critical, just always underlining the integrated nature of the industry. In terms of one area where I think there's, you know, real potential for cooperation going forward that will really appeal to the Biden administration, it's on the environmental side. You know, we've been able to be such a successful auto industry because we've maintained our alignment on regulatory alignment on environmental regulations, things related to GHG emissions, for example, with the U.S. That became more challenging for this government with the Trump administration, which was going in a bit of a different direction. Now the Biden administration is coming in. They've set very ambitious targets on GHG reductions and a desire to increase EV adoption and so on. So I think there's a real opportunity for cooperation between Canada and the U.S. The key here is that Canada has to continue to align with the U.S. on any changes to vehicle standards going forward, because that's, you know, we don't produce vehicles for different markets to different standards. It's a North American market. So I think that's an area for, you know, those early conversations where there could be real cooperation and interest on behalf of the incoming administration.
Andrea, and I guess I put the question to you, Andrea, because you've dealt with prime ministers and presidents. Is this an issue that should be on the top table, or is this one that we, you know, we're almost better to have it dealt with between the systems we've already set up, have our ambassadors and ministers, or is this one that really does have to have the prime minister and president look at?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I, you know, honestly think that the everything that we've accomplished over the last 4 years to renegotiate USMCA, put our trading relationship, particularly with respect to autos, on stable footing, I'm not sure it comes up as a PM president topic of conversation. I suspect that they'll have some other pressing things like the pandemic in China, but I think, you know, this will eventually come to their table. And I think what Brian and Flavio have contributed is exactly the right thing.
All right. Well, my final question, and I will go backwards. I'll start with you. Andrea, what are you reading these days?
So I'll give you two. I just finished Matthew McConaughey's Green Lights, which I thought was sort of an interesting collection of his thoughts about his career and his sort of path to success and how he charted it himself. And I also, because I'm just looking for fiction right now in the middle of the pandemic, I've started reading Agatha Christie's crime and mystery novels because I just need a little bit of an escape. Although Matthew McConaughey's book was also an escape from reality to some extent.
No, that's very good. And I got to tell you, Andrea, I'm back to reading Agatha Christie's, which I haven't read since I was a kid. And they're well written and they're great diversions. So thank you. Brian, what are you reading?
Well, I'm only 6 months into my new role at the CVMA, so I'm trying to learn everything possible about the auto sector. So I'm currently making my way through The People's Tycoon, Henry Ford and the American Century. It's a fantastic biography of his life and the creation of Ford. So getting up to speed on all things Ford, I'll have to do the same for General Motors and FCA Chrysler.
But Ford's a pretty good person to start with, and you get the history of America in it. Flavio, what are you reading? Flavio, what are you reading?
Yeah, I tell you, from a nonfiction point of view, I'm trying to read everything I can on battery technology and on natural resources like lithium and cobalt and all the other pieces that go into the EV chain. But from a fiction point of view, and I think we all need a little bit of an escape, I'm reading a book called The Chronicles of Astara by a Canadian author, Avram Reindorf, that it's set in ancient Egypt and it is a real, it's a real nice escape in this new lockdown and local author, and I'd recommend it for everybody.
Excellent, but I'm not gonna let you go because you talked about battery storage and yeah. You know, this is something I've seen Canada at now for 20 plus years. But I've not read anything recently that sort of brought it home. What's the best thing you've read on batteries so that the listeners could go to it and sort of understand more what this is all about?
Well, I would start with analyst reports. There was a great announcement 2 days ago from a company called Sayona Mining about investing in lithium mines in Val-d'Or, Quebec. Start out with what Quebec is doing and a company like Sayona is doing, and you'll end up in a rabbit hole that is extremely intricate and exciting, but also portends the long shadow between intent and reality on where Canada will play on this over the next few years.
Well, excellent. Well, I think we'll ask you to send the link to that, because what we'll do is we, at the end of the blurb, we always list what people have suggested. Well, thanks for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. We were joined today by Andrea Van Voigt, Brian Kingston, and Flavio Volpe. Remember, you can find the CJA Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute and that which we produce on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Charlotte Duval-Lantoine and to Drew Phillips for producing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thank you for joining us today on the Global Exchange.